Hello, my name is Allison Vaca, and I'm Assistant Professor of History at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and here today for the podcast series of the Society for Armenian Studies. We have the opportunity to talk today with Dr. Christina Morantsi, the Arthur H. Dardian and R. T. Oztemel Professor of Armenian Art and Architecture at Tufts University. Professor Morantsi's first book, Medieval Armenian Architecture, which came out in 2001, explored how concerns about race and nation inform the interpretation and classification of medieval Armenian art. We're here today to talk about her recent book, Vigilant Powers, Three Churches of Early Medieval Armenia, which was published by Brepols in 2015. It won the Sona Aronian Award for the Best English Language Volume on Armenian Studies from the National Association of Armenian Studies and Research in 2015, and the 2018 Karen Gold Prize of the Medieval Academy of America, an award for a book of outstanding quality in medieval art history. Thank you, Dr. Morantsi, for being with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Allison Vaca. It's a pleasure and an honor to be by the likes of you, yourself a very fine scholar, and I thank the SAS for organizing this podcast series. What a great idea, and I'm looking forward to it.
Great. So, before we get started on Vigilant Powers, could you explain to our listeners about your training and background? So, how did you get interested in art history?
Yeah, well, you know, since I was a child, I always loved horses, and I loved horses when I was a little girl, and never stopped. And then I started to just love everything that was pretty, and so I majored in art history in college. I also drew a little bit, like many art historians, recent art historians, I drew a little bit on the side, but I really loved learning about history through art, since I'm really no good at history. I liked art history. It doesn't really work like that, but, you know, I mean, art history, anyway. So I majored in art history at Vassar College, and I really started to kind of gravitate towards Armenian art through my training in medieval art, Western medieval art at Vassar. They didn't offer Armenian art, of course, and nobody knew much about it back in the 80s, I think it was. But it was through the kind of abstraction of medieval art that I found myself on a journey eastward via Byzantium to Armenia, where I found myself in graduate school. Yeah, so that's sort of that was kind of how it worked for me in a much more pragmatic sense. I applied to study Gothic architecture at Columbia my first year out of Vassar, and I didn't get in. And now looking back on it, I'm so glad. It took a few years for me to reorient, quite literally, take a trip with Nina Garsoyan to Kars and Artvin and Ani region, and find myself, pursuing Armenia. So sometimes things work out for the best, even though you don't know it at the time.
Yeah, it sounds like quite the voyage, especially to be able to travel with someone like Nina Garsoyan.
Yeah, it was incredible. Sorry, I just talked over you, but it was incredible. And Nicole Thierry was on that trip too. And it was a French group, and it was before I really knew anything about Armenia. You can imagine how strange that was. But the monuments of Tavkarjeti, in particular, will always stay with me for that reason. And I'm ever grateful to Nina Garsoyan and Thomas Matthews and Nicole Terry for really shepherding me towards Armenia at that formative moment.
Well, that sounds wonderful. So if you can just sort of start us off with a general overview of moving into talking about Vigilant Powers, could you just walk us through maybe the main arguments or some of the examples that you used, and maybe even also sort of like the parameters of how you decide what goes in the book?
Absolutely, sure. And just forgive my cat, Busty, because he will be interrupting at times. Okay, so the book focuses on three monuments, and it's a very close study of three monuments, which I'll talk about in more detail later, that belong to the 7th century and were produced between, let's say, the 620s and probably the 670s. And it might seem a very tiny, tiny little window into the vast and rich subject of Armenian art, but in fact, it's a very, very important one because of the historical moment in which those monuments were produced. So really, it's three chapters on, and each one a close study of the monument. And when I say the monument, I mean the architecture, the historical situation in which the monument was constructed. That is the patronage of the work, the powers that were around during that time. And as you know, they shifted around a fair amount in the 7th century. And sculpture and inscriptions. And the point was, and then there's an introduction and conclusion. But the point was to do some very close work on the monuments. And I keep saying that because general Armenian architecture, or let's say hitherto, Armenian architecture was typically studied for its formal and structural properties. And for those things are very interesting and important, but if you only study them, you miss out on, I think, a really fascinating historical insight into this critical moment in time. But also, you miss out on what architecture can do in a landscape and how it can change, how it can project ideas, and how it can reflect the situation around it as well. Often when we don't have other kinds of sources that say the same thing. So I was very keen on being as rigorous and diligent as I could with the monument in its totality. And so I did that for, understandably, as you can imagine, only three monuments. But I think it could be done with other monuments as well. So that's the kind of the shape of the book.
Wonderful, thanks. So you mentioned the historical moment of the 7th century, and particularly as a critical moment in time. Could you, for some of the listeners, especially who maybe work on the more modern period, explain a little bit about, you know, the placement of Armenia and what's going on in the 7th century?
Right, in that. So in the 7th century, Armenia is positioned as a kind of border between the Byzantine world and first the Sasanian Persian world, and then within a few decades of the 7th century, emerging Islamic world. And this is a radical change, that historians used to, correct me, Alison, you're a historian, but historians used to think about as a kind of break between the Middle Ages. But in any event, however you want to slice it, does mean kind of reconfiguring of the political landscape of the Mediterranean and the Near East. So what's so interesting is that in this moment, when you have a shift from the Byzantine sphere, Byzantine and Persian sphere, to a Byzantine and Islamic world kind of emerging, you have just at this moment in the mid 7th century, you have the production of large corpus of monuments, nothing like anything else in West Asia or really many other places around the Mediterranean are doing this. So it was a great question to me as to what these monuments were doing being built at this moment, and what it revealed about local conditions for me was very interesting. I think that we all need to do a better job of thinking across boundaries, and for me it was really important to read historical sources as much as I could to think about the setting of these monuments in their context and the roles of the patrons in the broader historical frame. So for example, my first chapter on Meren looked very closely at local elites and their relationship with the Emperor Heraclius, and what I found in some ways complemented the narrative that we hear from the history attributed to Suvios, which is a 7th century historical chronicle of great importance to understanding the Near East and the emerging Islamic world. So I was very interested in how, again, taking the example of Meren, how Marin could be understood in that in a contextual and historical contextual way.
Right, thanks. So if we can continue on with the discussion of Marin then. I thought this was a really interesting analysis here of the image of Heraclius and the return of the true cross, the cross that supposedly Jesus was crucified on, and sort of the political implications of what that meant, that he had to go all the way to go retrieve it. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about sort of Armenian understandings of Heraclius and how he was portrayed. But also you mentioned Zebios, and I was kind of curious as well as the other sources that you used to tell this story.
That's a good question. I'll start with the first thing, Armenian understanding of Heraclius. So, as much as we can tell, and I rely on Tim Greenwood for educating me on this subject, Heraclius was understood as a kind of victorious figure with the reclamation or the return of the cross after after it was held hostage by the Persians. And this is revealed in Sabius, but also in the inscription at Marin, where we hear him talked about as the all-praiseworthy, and I'm forgetting the Armenian term now, Heraclius, on the foundation inscription. So this, in a way, kind of complements what we know about him from Sabios. But there's other kinds of evidence, archaeological evidence for Heraclian Salidi that were found, for example, at Tabin. So one can put together a picture of an emperor who was well known in Armenian circles. And of course, there's the whole question about his own ethnicity, which I will not get into at this time. But he was closely connected to the Armenian world. And in my book, I go on at some length about his interest in confessional compromise between the Armenian communities. So there are many points of contact between Heraclius and Armenia. And I think Marin can be understood in that frame. Does that help?
Yeah, it's great. Thank you. Besides Marin, you also talk a lot, you have a chapter on Svartnots, which I think is probably the most recognizable church for a general audience, since the ruins remain today so close to Yerevan. And you can even see the proposed reconstructions or how it may have looked in the museum in Yerevan, of course. Could you tell us a bit in general about this church and why it matters and maybe why it's captured the imagination of so many people?
Oh, what a great question. I love Svartnots. I would love a church that looks like that in reconstruction. You may hear a fight break out among my cats right now because I hear growling, so just, okay, I think it just passed. Okay, so Svartnots is just an amazing building. First of all, it's unprecedented design. Essentially around structure, it's actually sided, and within it is a quatrefoil, which is made up of open exterior columns. This is amazing. So we don't see this anywhere else, as far as we know. Of course, you always, you know, wonder about what's underneath the ground, but I think that's a part of it, that it's so unusual. I think another part of it is sort of the modern structure. So formally, it's very interesting, and of course, we know that Ibios describes it, and later chronicles describe it as this magnificent, unbelievable place. So it has a whole kind of Nachleben in the sources. Sorry, it's Somerville, so you're gonna have to deal with some occasional ambulances. So there's a whole kind of life that this monument has that suggests that when it was standing, it was really a remarkable building. Almost a mythology of Svartnots grows up around it. Okay. But the modern story of Svartnots is equally interesting. If you go to Svartnots, you see a big bust of Toramanian, Fos Toramanian, who was one of the archaeologists at the site, and who created those iconic construction drawings and models. I have written about this in a separate piece, but I think part of what captures our attention about Spa Monks is not just sort of 7th century moments, the ruins of which you can see if you go to the site, but also this kind of mythology that grows up around it, both the medieval and the modern, and Torre Monion's association with that monument. Even extending now into the middle of the 20th century with the industrial interpretation of Zvartmansk in the Zvartmansk airport. So it just goes on and on. It's just an amazing building, and it's unusual in the context of Armenian architecture. It's unusual in the context of really any architectural tradition. So, of course, I had to talk about it. Plus, for the purpose of my book, there are inscriptions and there is relief sculpture. And I should just say as an aside that what I tried to do with choosing these three, that was probably going to be one of your questions, with choosing these three is pick ones that had the most sort of data of different kinds. So not just the building, but an inscription, not just those two things, but sculpture. Even better to have historical sources talk about the building so that I could use the ones that were the most sort of robustly attested in a variety of ways. And Zvartmansk was obviously one of those.
Right, perfect. Thanks. So your third example, though, you talk about the Iranian ethos of medieval Armenia, and this is particularly interesting for me for my own work, so I'll go ahead and be a little selfish here and ask you to kind of put this into an art historical context for me about the connections between Iran and how that shows up in our material evidence.
Yeah, well, I'm doing an interview with you on your book because I want to hear more about that from you, but okay, I will talk a little bit about how I see it. So as you know, there's been a lot of work on the kind of Iranian, Darslan uses the term substratum, or this kind of sense of Iranization that we have in Armenia in early periods. And we can see this, you know, we see it in a variety of textual sources. But we also can see it in material and visual ways. And art historians like Tom Matthews have looked to representations of the Magi, for example, in the 7th century part of the Etchmiadzin Gospels, among various kinds of examples. What I looked at with Poderny is in contrast to Zvartmansk and Uren, Poderny doesn't come with any really helpful information in terms of sources, textual sources. What we have is almost limited to the bas-relief imagery on the church, which I looked at very carefully, obviously, because I believe that imagery can tell its own story and isn't necessarily, let's let me put it this way, it's interesting as historical information. You just have to read it. So the imagery of Poderny shows a scene of Christ with apostles, three on each side. This is on the south facade of the church. And then two scenes of hunters, one of them with a bow and arrow and one on a horseback and the other with a pole weapon. And the one with the bow and arrow on horseback really looks like something you might, it evokes what you would see in Sasanian silver from the same period and earlier. So I was very interested in thinking about potential meaning of the hunter. And so I looked at Sasanian silver and started thinking about the hunt and what it meant in that context. And this silver connects us also to banqueting, which is another theme I explore when looking at the north facade of Poderny, which shows vessels, carved vessels. And who was it? I think it was, I forget now who the scholar was who said or noted that the vessels that we see carved onto the north facade of Poderny look a lot like Sasanian vessels. Ewers, for example, pitchers, ewers, various kinds of tall vessels, some with handles, some without. So this, again, pointed me towards towards Stanian work and towards the banquet. And so it really became a church that, for me, expressed the expressed visually the noble pastimes par excellence in both the Armenian and the Iranian world of banqueting and hunting. And so that's the context. And as an expression of elite status in Armenia, so I used that and put it together with what we know about the presumed patrons of the Amatuni to develop my kind of narrative about the church. So it was fun. It was different from the other two churches in that it was really a kind of more of a visual, of looking at the visual evidence in a very different frame and thinking about the connections with Sasanian imagery and what that might mean.
Wonderful, thanks. Yeah, I think these connections, both not just between Armenia and Iran, but Armenia and the broader world, are part of what makes Vigilant Powers a really such a successful book. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more. You know, you say you're going to place Armenian architecture on a world stage. Could you just explain that for a minute? And
yeah, sure. So really, I love that term. I guess
I do too.
This was something I thought about a lot with Zvartnots, and I'll just return, if I can just return to Zvartnots for a minute. So Zvartnots is a church that has been interpreted in a variety of ways. Some scholars see in it Byzantine connections. I did myself. Very strong in terms of Greek inscriptions and Greek iconography from Byzantine steels can be found in this the sculptural program. And the patron's own connections with the Byzantine sphere. But some of the other scholars see it in relation to Syria and Mesopotamian monuments, because there we find not exact, because Zvartnots is unprecedented, but similar ground plans of what we call, in the parlance of architectural historians, aisle tetrachons. And some other historians put it into the context of Jerusalem and look at connections with the Anastasis Rotunda. Those scholars focus particularly on the round exterior shell. So I was really struck. I think when you're working at a church like that, you just think, well, what is it? And it came to me. I started thinking about it. And this came really after reading Sibios and the Anonymous Chronicle from the 7th century and Ananya Shirakatsi's geography. That what's so interesting about the texts of the time, if we read them, we get this kind of strong consciousness of a broader world, particularly with the arrival of Islam. This is really a kind of global moment, at least that's how I construe it. And if we think about how texts do that, and I'm not making this up, this is Mahe who said this before me, but if we think about, you know, by his observations in relation to the churches, and particularly Zvartnots. I think I'm really talking about Zvartnots here. You can think about it not just as a kind of set of fractured stylistic connections with various traditions, but in fact as a kind of coming together, a convergence of cultures at this particular moment in which Armenia really is in the middle of everything. And then putting that together with the structural appearance of the church, Zvartnots, set up on this stepped platform, it very much belongs to a kind of architectural, it makes me think of an architectural statement like the Dome of the Rock, which is how I end that chapter. That this, I think, if we're going to think about the relationship of texts and architecture, we can build an idea that really shows how architecture makes a statement about its place in the world. And I think that Zvartnots does that, and not an unsimilar way to the Dome of the Rock in terms of the kinds of arguments it makes as a building, that is kind of establishing authority in the landscape and a kind of giving the sense of universality. So we can think about those various influences, you know, whether Jerusalemic, Syria, Byzantine, Armenian, as a totality that is placing Armenia and Zvartnots for sure on this world stage. That's a kind of little summation of what I try to talk about in that chapter. But, of course, my own goals as an architectural historian is to place Armenia on the world stage, and we'll get there. I think eventually Armenia will take center stage in architectural history. It's going to happen.
Yes, definitely. Right, so I'm out of curiosity's sake, could you maybe pick out a single kind of fun fact or detail that you kind of came across as you were working on this project, or you stumbled onto that kind of struck your fancy? Or
absolutely. My favorite, and the one that is the most nerdy of all, is the inscription at Meren that I deciphered. And the story of Meren is very interesting, and I've told it elsewhere, but I was essentially in the building, kind of hiding, and took a lot of pictures, and I took pictures of the apsidal inscription, which hadn't been translated before. It's really fragmentary, and I don't know. I mean, so I had to take careful pictures, and then together with Stephen Sim, who is a virtual Ani person, he made an Adobe Illustrator version of the you know, using all the photographs he made in Adobe Illustrator with that program, made a kind of drawing of the apps together and with the inscription. So with the letters that were there, I was like, I had to figure out what the inscription said, of course. And it was hard because some of the letters weren't put down correctly in the Adobe. So there were some differences there. Anyway, so I tried for a long time. I had only just a few letters, but I mean, you knew it was going to be a particular kind of text. It wasn't going to be like a list of, what you needed to buy for the day on the apps. So I finally found it, but it was like going a weekend without, taking a shower. But you can imagine how happy I was when I figured it out. You can read the story of that. Not the story of me figuring it out, but you can read about the inscription in the book.
Wonderful. So you also have another book coming out very soon, or is it already out?
That came out hot off the press like 2 days ago.
Wow, wonderful. Congratulations. This is a textbook called The Art of Armenia, published by Oxford University Press, so obviously it's pretty exciting. Could you maybe give us a sneak snippet preview of what this is about?
Sure. So it's a guide. It's not a survey, so don't expect anything gigantic. It's a guide to Armenian art, and it ranges from prehistory to the early 18th century, all media, and it's really meant to give non-specialists, or just the non-art historian, an introduction to Armenian art, and an updated introduction, because our previous surveys are from like the 1980s, so it was time to do something that was updated, reflected the changes in the field, the discoveries that have been made, and was accessible for students and scholars alike, and really came out of my own teaching and my own feeling like I just need something I can assign to students that's going to be, readable and accessible and hopefully get them excited about the field. So that was my goal with this.
Wonderful. Looking forward to reading it. It sounds great.
And
with two books out in such a really short span, do I dare even ask what's next? Is it sleep or watching Netflix or something? Because that would be understandable.
No, I'm just doing that because you know how it is with a book. There's always this lag time. I am on to something new. I'm very interested in the 10th, 11th centuries, and I'm interested in architecture and in the Bagratid zone, but I'm really thinking about how to connect that with the liturgy. As you know, we have the ritual or mashdot from that period. We have, texts dating from that period, liturgical texts. So I've been reading those, reading about consecrations and foundations, and I want to weave those into my study of 10th and 11th century architecture and sculpture in the northern part of Armenia. So that is what I'm kind of diving into, or rather just wading into, I guess, at this moment.
Wonderful. Well, we're looking forward to seeing what comes up next.
Yeah.
And we really appreciate the time that you took to come and talk to us a little bit about Vigilant Powers, which is a wonderful book and very informative. And
I appreciate it. And thank you for the excellent interviewing. And thank you to the SAS for this great opportunity.
Right, yes. Thank you also for the SAS for just creating a forum where we can even kind of air out some ideas.
Love it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you. Okay.
Bye.